Healthcare Today with Dr. Lewis Myers, a weekly exploration of health and wellness topics affecting Vermonters. Brought to you in part by Westview Meadows and the Gary Residence, retirement living the way it's meant to be. Age Well Vermont, the leading experts and advocates for older adults in northwestern Vermont. Northfield Pharmacy, pharmacy care with a personalized hometown touch. Northfieldpharmacy.com. And Kinney Drugs and KinneyDrugs.com, employee owned and locally committed. Your participation is encouraged. Call with your questions, 244-1777 or 877-291-8255.
Good afternoon and welcome to Healthcare Today. I'm Dr. Lewis Myers. On a snow and windy day in Waterbury, I hope wherever you are, you're warm and safe. We're going to be talking today about kidney disease, both acute and chronic kidney disease. Chronic kidney disease affects 15% of the United States population and an even higher number in developing countries. What are the risk factors and causes for kidney disease? What are the treatments? And what can we do to prevent the disease over the many years? My guests today are Marianne Wendell from Alexandria, Virginia, who has experienced chronic kidney disease for many years and is going to tell us some of her journey through that process. And also with us from the San Francisco Bay Area is Dr. Andrew Howard, who, by a disclaimer I should note, was Ms. Wendell's nephrologist for many years. And he's one of the nation's experts on kidney transplantation. He's going to talk to us today about kidney disease and the progress we've made in treating it. Welcome to you both.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Ms. Wendell, I'd like to start with you. Can you tell us when it was you first began to recognize that you had kidney disease, and what were your symptoms?
I first found out that I had kidney disease. I was probably in my early 20s. I started to have urinary tract infections, some discomfort, and then I had, because there's kidney disease in the family, I have polycystic kidney disease, and it's hereditary. So we already knew there was kidney disease in the family, so they tested me for that in my mid-20s, and that's when I found out that I did have cysts on the kidneys.
Can you tell us a little bit more about what polycystic kidney disease is?
Polycystic kidney disease is when cysts form on your native kidneys and they get larger and multiply. And typically around your mid-40s is when you start to have loss of kidney function, and your creatinine, which is one of the numbers that they follow, goes down, goes up. Usually it runs around 0.5 up to 1.2 is fairly good. And then it starts to creep up. Mine crept up to, I want to say, maybe around a 12. And by then I was in total kidney failure pretty much and had to start on dialysis.
What other symptoms did you have over the years?
I had pain. I had no real symptoms until I was older. I had pain and then, you know, loss of urine output. I had a little bit of a metal taste in my mouth towards the end. But other than that, it was nothing that, like, really stood out that, oh, this is terrible. And it was just a gradual process over the years.
You mentioned that polycystic kidney disease is a genetically inherited disease. I believe it's an autosomal dominant disease, which means that if one of your parents have it, you have at least 50% chance. So you were in your 20s when you learned this. What was that like to hear about your family's history and to know you were at such risk?
The interesting thing, because we knew we had the kidney disease in the family, I had been tested when I was probably around the age of 13 for the kidney disease with an IV test, and it came back negative. So I went on with my life thinking, no, I didn't have, I was one of the lucky ones. I didn't have it. Both my brothers had it. My mother was the one with the kidney disease. I had my children And it wasn't until after I had my children when I started having the other symptoms. And they said, well, you know, let's just go and check just to be sure. Even though you had a test and it said it was negative. So it was a little bit upsetting afterwards. I don't know that I would have changed anything by not having children. But I had already had my children by then. And it wasn't until my son was out of high school because he didn't want to know, because he couldn't play sports. My daughter is negative. My son is positive. I have two brothers that had it. My older brother, both his children have the disease, and my younger brother, one of his children has the disease. So it's quite prominent in our family as far as being inherited by the following generations. There were 8 children in my mother's family, and only one other brother had it. But all his children have the disease.
I should note that small, simple cysts are common, and we see a lot of these now incidental findings on as we do more and more CAT scans for other conditions. But the kind of cysts that Ms. Wendell's talking about grow larger and larger and begin to, as she noted, cause many symptoms and also can eventually lead to renal failure. Now, you got to the point where your creatinine was in the 12 range, which is generally end-stage renal disease. Your kidneys were not functioning. You were becoming more symptomatic. You were working at that time, I'm sure, with Dr. Howard. What was the next step in your treatment?
The next step was we decided that it was time to put a shunt in my arm for dialysis. They evaluated my veins, and my veins weren't very good, so they put a shunt in prior to ever starting dialysis. We knew the next step was dialysis.
What was the deciding factor that led to beginning dialysis?
The fact that my kidney function had dropped to like 25%.
And when you started dialysis, can you tell us a little bit about what that experience was like for you?
Sure. I went 3 times a week, and it averaged about 4 hours each time. You're limited on the amount that you can drink. You're limited on high potassium foods, milk and dairy products, because they all raise your numbers. So you go and you get hooked up to a dialysis machine, which is like a kidney, and you sit there for 4 hours. You can, a lot of people sleep. They have a television that you can watch. You don't feel very well for the day after your treatment, but the next day you feel better. And then it's all over again. If you're really compliant, things go much better, which means you limit the amount of your fluid intake is very strict. You make sure you're eating the proper foods, you're getting your exercise, you're doing the things that you need to do to stay healthy.
Let me take one minute to let our
time.
I'm sorry. Let me take 1 minute to let our listeners know that if you have any questions for Ms. Wendell or for Dr. Howard, who's going to talk with us in a moment, please give us a call at 802-244-1777. That's 802-244-1777. If you'd like to text a question, you can text us at 802-585-3026. So, Ms. Wendell, as you described dialysis, it's obviously was and is life-saving when you end up in at very end-stage renal disease, but it's not ideal. You have to live your life rather strictly in terms of activity, diet, fluids, and then, of course, you're spending at least 4 hours every other day or 3 times a week at the dialysis center, plus getting there and coming back. How many years were you on dialysis?
I was on dialysis for 6 years.
And what was the next step in your journey in kidneys?
Well, the next step would be a kidney transplant. Unfortunately, I was very much overweight. I weighed somewhere around 350 pounds, and I was told I had to lose at least over 100 pounds just to be able to get onto a transplant list. So my next step was my children were just teenagers. So I went and I did, there was an option for me to have gastric banding done. So I went through the process of having gastric banding done. Not always the best for losing that much weight, but that was the option that was available to me at the time. I was able to lose, it took me about a year to lose the 100 pounds, and then I was able to get onto a transplant list.
So going forward with getting on a transplant list is a very involved process. Is it not?
It is. You have to find a transplant unit in your local area. You have to go in and you have to be evaluated to make sure that you're a candidate. Make sure your heart is healthy. Make sure, you know, any other underlying conditions that you may have that they can take care of prior to a transplant, they take care of those. You have labs done every month to make sure that you're being compliant and following, you know, your dietary restrictions. And then you wait. And the wait, you know, you get multiple phone calls and we'll be told, okay, we have a kidney. Sometimes you'll actually have to go to the hospital, and then you can be told no at that time. It's something happened, and it just didn't work out.
Did that happen in your case? Did you have a false alarm, so to speak?
Multiple times. Mm. Multiple times. My blood type is O positive. That is probably one of the harder you can only get from an O positive donor. Most other blood types you can get from multiple blood donors, blood types.
So it must have been an emotional roller coaster.
It was. Not for me, because I just kept thinking, well, I just need to learn to have more patience. And, you know, my family, it was very difficult for them because they would get very excited that, okay, she's finally going to have the transplant, and then it would be a letdown.
What year did you have finally have your transplant?
I had 6 years after. I was on dialysis for 6 years. I waited probably about a year for the transplant.
So what year was that that you?
2008, I had my transplant. So I'll be 12 years out in June. Once you have the transplant, your life totally changes. You get your time back. You get your health back. You are no restrictions.
So the kidney started working almost immediately.
It did.
Yeah. Now, one of the, and Dr. Howard will talk more about this, but one of the major concerns after transplant is the body rejecting the new kidney. And anyone who's had a transplant has to go on immunosuppressant medications. So you've been on those for nearly 12 years now.
Yes. I take two different anti-rejection medications, and those I have taken every day for 12 years and will be on the rest of my life.
Are there any side effects from those that you've experienced, or just the
there
routine?
There are. One of the medications I take caused neuropathy in my fingers and in my feet. So I have like a little tingling constantly. I'm more susceptible to infection, so I have to be careful of that. When I do get sick, I have a tendency to get very sick because my immune system is decreased because of the anti-rejections.
Just going back for a minute, you mentioned that prior to becoming pregnant and delivering your two children, you were not aware that you had polycystic kidney disease, but it sounds like you would have gone forward with the pregnancies anyway. But in an autosomal dominant, particularly in an autosomal dominant, where you know there may be a 50% chance of your children, one or more of your children having this, what would that have been like for you if you knew beforehand?
You know, if I'd have known beforehand, we might have gone through some genetic testing because it was available at the time. My son that has the PKD, they did do the genetic testing, and they ended up doing having their daughter tested in utero to see if she had before my daughter-in-law became pregnant, and they were able to tell whether she had the disease because they took some of my genetic tests and some of my son's, and they were able to isolate the gene so they could make sure when they were doing in vitro that they could test each embryo to see if they had the genetic marker.
Well, happen to know that both of your adult children are wonderful people, and hope both are doing well. And I want you to stay on the line, but I want to thank you for sharing your story, because knowing you over the years, as I have, I know that you have faced every step of the way with courage and real fortitude. And I think listeners can probably hear that in your voice. I want to turn now to Dr. Andrew Howard, who is on the line with us from the San Francisco Bay Area. As I mentioned earlier, Dr. Howard, when he was in Alexandria, Virginia, in practice, was Miss Wendell's nephrologist for many years. So he can comment, if he would like, on some of the specifics, but we're going to talk more generally about kidney disease. Dr. Howard went to undergraduate Williams College, following which he worked in the lab of two Nobel laureates in New York City at the Rockefeller Institute, Rockefeller University. He went to medical school at Tulane University's in New Orleans. He then went into the military and did his residency in internal medicine at Walter Reed in Washington, D.C., where he also became chief resident. He stayed at Walter Reed to do his nephrology fellowship and ended up as the medical director of the dialysis unit there, retired from the Army with the rank of major. And subsequently in Alexandria, Virginia, and the Fairfax County, Virginia, for many years, was on staff at numerous hospitals and has also been involved in nationally in kidney transplant issues. Dr. Howard, welcome.
Thank you. Thank you, Dr. Myers. Ms. Wendell, wonderful to hear your voice again. Hard to believe I've been out here.
Yeah.
Been out here now since summer of 2019.
Well, Dr. Howard, let me ask you, as I do ask some of our guests, what led you to become a nephrologist, to want to focus on diseases of the kidney?
Yeah, no, that's a great question. I think it's a great place to start. Nephrology is probably one of, in terms of number of physicians who go into its practice, as Dr. Myers and Ms. Wendell, of course, knows, one of the smaller areas of medicine. In medical school, I was always fascinated with how the kidney worked. Here you have this organ that literally, for your listeners, as you well know, of course, Dr. Myers, is no bigger really than the size of a fist. Yet what this organ can do, and we, of course, can't live without this organ functioning, in addition to clearing waste products from the blood, regulating our salt and water balance, regulating every electrolyte in the body. Also, a number of critical hormones are made. Just to mention one for your listeners that may surprise many of them, fully active vitamin D is actually made by the kidney. Of course, when our kidneys are functioning, we just take that for granted. But once we lose that function, we actually have a replacement vitamin D, which is synthetic, but it is fully active. The other critical hormone that, again, we just take for granted is the hormone erythropoietin, or EPO as we shorten it, is what allows our bone marrow to make red blood. Again, who would think? Go figure. But as all patients with advanced chronic kidney disease know, they're dependent on receiving other medications. And thank goodness, as of 1989, we actually had those medications, and Ms. Wendell, as Dr. Myers know, we're on the cusp of a sea change in how we treat these with, believe it or not, after all those years of getting shots and having it injected through the dialysis machine, when you were on it and receiving it as a injection in the skin before that, we actually are set to use pills to treat anemia. Again, these aren't approved yet. The FDA next March will make its decision on the first of these medicines, but again, just very, very exciting. So anyway, I got to my internship, and ironically, I think as I told you, Dr. Myers, I'd actually been accepted in a head and neck surgery program at Tulane. Go figure, this guy became a nephrologist. Interestingly, my first attending on medicine, which happened to be my first month as an intern, was the assistant chief of the nephrology service at Walter Reed. Just an incredible human being, an incredible doctor. I had always liked nephrology. He just had a profound effect on me. And I made a decision fairly quickly that that's what I wanted to do. So hence I became a nephrologist.
You know, many people go through medical school know the or describe the kidneys as the black box because they are extraordinarily complex. As you said, they're very small organs, but extraordinarily complex. And understanding them really helps you to understand the physiology of the entire body. So it's in many ways, it's probably the most complex organ in the body. We want to talk about acute and chronic and perhaps acute on chronic kidney disease, because they are different, to some degree, they're different diseases. Can you tell us some of the causes for acute kidney disease? What causes kidneys to go bad quickly?
Sure. Absolutely. I'll be happy to. So one of the things that nephrologists are faced with, of course, whether patients are referred to them in the office or not uncommonly, they are asked to see patients in the hospital. Is this acute? And by that we mean, is it of sudden onset? And that would imply our initial approach is that we can reverse this. We can make it better. But, of course, we have to figure out why. So probably the first and most common reason really for that are changes in blood flow. So the kidney is responsible for processing all the blood in our body. It's filled with blood vessels and this amazing system of filters and little tubules that are attached to it. But anything that would lead to a decrease in blood, so most simply, obviously, if blood pressure is low from a variety of different reasons, a patient could have a cardiac reason for low blood pressure. It could be related to medication. Even diving deeper inside the kidney to the level of the filters, it may be that blood pressure is actually maintained, but the little arteries that either enter or exit each little filter are themselves affected. And a number of medications can, of course, do this. Obviously, if patients are having blood loss, that's an obvious reason for a drop in blood pressure. The other thing that we've seen so painfully with COVID that we've gone through is any infection, particularly serious infections. We often use the word sepsis, which by that physicians, of course, mean a bloodstream infection. But you can have a sepsis-like syndrome. And COVID has, of course, led to many, many instances of acute kidney injury in the setting of many other organs in the body being affected.
Do we know whether COVID specifically attacks the kidney? It causes a sepsis-like picture, but does it specifically attack the kidney?
That's actually a great question, Dr. Myers. And yes, it is interesting, but there is data that the kidneys are one of the organs that COVID, the coronavirus, can actually have distinct effects within the kidney. It's not unique to COVID. There are other viruses that can also affect kidney function because of the complex interplay between these filters, the blood vessels that supply the kidney, the tubules attached to the filters where all the exchange of water and electrolytes and salts occur. So the answer is yes. It's both a general effect leading to a severe infection with what we call multiple organ failure. That would be more akin to the sepsis model, but there also can be intrinsic effects.
We're going to come back, and we have a lot more to talk about. We do have to take a break. I want listeners, if you have any questions today, to call us at 802-244-1777. We're going to be back with Ms. Wendell and Dr. Howard in just a moment. And we're back for the second half, talking about kidney disease with Mary Ann Wendell and Dr. Andrew Howard. Dr. Howard, just before the break, we were talking about COVID and how it affects the kidneys. Now, there have been certainly well over a million or millions of cases of COVID in the United States over the past year. Are we seeing a significant increase in patients needing dialysis because of COVID?
So the answer to that, Dr. Myers, is there have been patients who have developed acute kidney injury where the recovery from that has been slower, and they have had to transition out of the hospital onto dialysis. So that has happened. We don't actually have the total numbers yet, but now that 2020 is finished, we will have that data. I did want to mention that the case rate in the dialysis population is quite high. I'm going to just give you some broad numbers. I happen to look, and where I am now on the West Coast, the state of California, I believe, had a positivity rate of around 6.4% this morning. The current positivity rate in the dialysis population across the country, this is just taking all 50 states, is in the neighborhood of about 60%. So again, let me just repeat those. For the state of California, 6.4% for the dialysis population, a 60% positivity.
That is stunning.
Striking.
And what accounts for that?
Well, I think there are a number of reasons. First of all, initially, of course, we began to recognize more about how this is spread, and there are ways to actually genetically, if you will, profile the different variants of the COVID virus and look. But initially, as Ms. Wendell well knows, in the in-center dialysis setting, where hemodialysis is performed, as Ms. Wendell was on, the patients are sitting fairly close to each other, and they have to come on a regular basis. So there were all the precautions taken appropriately, but it's just a setting where, unfortunately, the potential risks while you're in the waiting room and on dialysis were certainly there. Again, as we as a country learn more and more about this, and we improved our risk mitigation strategies for COVID, this did become less and less. But I think initially some of the spread was there. A number of our patients also are not able to drive themselves or be driven by a family member, but are dependent on a public type of transport to get to dialysis. So again, one additional risk. And again, what I haven't mentioned is the hospitalization rate from COVID for our patients on dialysis was quite high, as well as the need for ongoing medical care from other providers beside the nephrologist who takes care of that patient on dialysis. So just a number of potential different exposures.
We talked about, we were also begun talking about acute causes for kidney injury, but let's talk about how if an acute kidney injury does not recover, or if there's a more chronic condition such as polycystic kidney disease, such as Ms. Wendell had, how do you make the decision on when it's time to start dialysis?
Sure. Excellent question. Let me, if I could, just mention one last thing with acute, because I'd be remiss for your listeners if I didn't bring this up. So one of the other things nephrologists just have to think about, and, you know, Lewis, when you were in med school, of course, we talked about, although we don't really necessarily use these terms anymore, but pre-renal before the kidney, that would be the low blood pressure impairing blood flow, things within the kidney, and then the post-renal. So certainly one of the things nephrologists at least think about when they're asked to see a case, whether it be in the office or the hospital, particularly in men, because of the fact that a prostate gland, if it's still there, is present and potentially causing a problem. As our prostates as men do enlarge as we grow older, is, if you will, blockage of urine outflow. The reason that that's so critical to pick up is the patient may or may not be aware that that's an issue unless specific questions are asked. And there can be a fairly sizable amount of obstruction or blockage of urine outflow, which eventually can lead to kidney damage, which if caught early is totally reversible. But unfortunately, if we miss that and it's caught late, damage can be done. So just wanted to mention that. So once we've reached the point that we're contemplating what we call kidney replacement therapy, or as we used to say, renal replacement, there's several different options. I think first, and Ms. Wendell gave just a wonderful story because she touched upon so many of these issues. So I think the first thing that we're confronted with, as you said, and it was the best question to ask Dr. Myers, is can we do anything to reverse this? Can we make this better? If not, step two is, and there are some very exciting things we'll get to later, but what can we do to stabilize kidney function? How can we slow this down from getting worse where we reach the point where we need to consider dialysis or kidney transplant? And obviously, it depends upon what the condition is. Again, for Ms. Wendell's kidney disease, polycystic, there is a very exciting development now, which we've had for the last few years, which unfortunately, when Ms. Wendell first presented, we did not have. But again, a treatment option that we've got now. So let's just say we've reached the point that we see dialysis or transplant on the horizon. In my view, first and foremost for every patient is the option of transplant. Is this a possibility? If possible, and Ms. Wendell told you in her situation why this wasn't initially, but is it possible to do what we call a preemptive or before dialysis transplant? Obviously, if there's a potential living donor, whether it's someone genetically related or not genetically related, that obviously can facilitate or allow a much more rapid transplant. But again, I can't overemphasize enough how important it is. If the patient wants a transplant and is a transplant candidate, to be open to the idea of, if you will, this preemptive transplant. I can tell you nationally, we've got a long way to go. If you look at the incident or what happened that past year, of all patients who are new to either dialysis or transplant, less than 3% nationally receive a preemptive transplant. This is something we focused on intensively, and I'm very proud of the fact that our practice had about a 10% rate of preemptive.
Let me can I ask you another question?
Please. Yeah.
Kidney transplants are done either through cadaver, someone who has died and has donated their organs, mm-hmm. or a living transplant, which is matched to the recipient. And which is more effective?
So a living donor transplant, particularly one that has a high degree of match, and you're more likely to see that, obviously, if it's someone who you share DNA with, that is going to be the most successful in terms of the longevity of the transplant. However, we have made incredible strides. Now, again, the reason a living donor, whether it's a related or non-related, if you will, is that's a planned surgery. The kidney goes right from the donor into the recipient. There's no, if you will, downtime. With a deceased donor transplant, obviously there has to be some obligate time between harvesting the kidney and when it's transplanted into the recipient. You can still, and we do look, so certainly the better the match, the better it is for the patient. But the answer to the question, Lewis, is the best of all would be the living donor. Now, having said that, though, I can tell you what I saw over, gosh, my 30 years out in the military in private practice is an incredible change in terms of the survival of the transplants where, interestingly, initially you were looking for deceased donors at maybe a third of what a living donor would be, so 10 versus 30 years, to where we had many, many deceased donors who were out over 20 years.
There's a terrible lack of, I'm sure our listeners know, a terrible lack of organs for transplant, and particularly in the minority communities. How can we improve availability? And is there any research being done to a synthetic kidney that would not even be a human tissue?
So Because we're on the radio, you can see the big smile on my face. And yes, there's something very exciting. A lot of the research actually done right at UCSF with help from Vanderbilt. And that's called the bioartificial kidney. So let me start with that and let me get back to the other point because that is critical. So there has been a lot of work done on what's called the bio, if you will, artificial kidney. And this would actually be a implantable kidney, if you will, is created in the lab. It uses, if you will, not getting too much into the details, but some, if you will, tissue actually with bioengineered structure. But certainly this created organ is small enough, it can be surgically implanted and actually functions like a transplant. And they are on the cusp of human trials with that. So some very, very exciting work. Of course, the other issue would be trying, if you will, through stem cell research to actually grow a kidney, and work is being done on that. And last but not least, there would be the issue of using a suitable animal kidney to transplant into human. I know some of your listeners may go, what? What did he say? But it actually turns out that the pig kidney is in many ways similar to the human kidney. There are some issues which need to be worked out, but I just want your listeners to know that there are multiple paths being explored. However, for human kidneys, first and foremost, the most important step all of us can do is when we get our driver's license and we're asked, do you want to be an organ donor, to say yes. I can assure you, if there are concerns, God forbid, this is the worst of times because it means someone has passed away. But the wonderful people with the organ procurement organizations who actually send teams out to hospitals to harvest these organs will talk with the family prior to anything being done. But really, we certainly know, Dr. Myers, if you compare us to other countries in the world where it's almost universal in terms of organ donation, we are not at that point in the U.S., so we could certainly do better. But that begins with each one of us simply saying, yes, I'll, if appropriate, I will designate that at the time of my death, I will be an organ donor.
We want to take a call briefly from Nancy in Washington, D.C.
Hi, good afternoon, and thank you. This is great information. I actually am a nurse practitioner at your old alma mater, Walter Reed, and could probably guesstimate that about 80% of my patients are on their way to kidney disease due to hypertension, diabetes. And I'm just wondering, before the show ends, if you could just take a moment, just very kind of simply, and address, are there any dietary measures that we could try to be teaching them and with these other chronic diseases that lead to kidney disease, any just basics for kidney that would hopefully help, offer some prevention for them developing full-blown kidney disease?
Thank you, Nancy.
Yes, thank you. Oh, very exciting to talk to somebody. Yeah, I, of course, as you know, I left in 1989, but I had almost 10 years at the old Walter Reed, as I call it. In terms of diet, it's actually interesting. If you go back to the 1980s, there was a very famous study called the Modification of Diet in Renal Disease, or MDRD. And of course, as our caller knows very well, one of the equations used for years to estimate kidney function from the blood creatinine test that Ms. Wendell was talking about back at the beginning, how she was identified having kidney disease, came out of that study. I vividly remember at the American Society of Nephrology in the 1985-86 time period, 87, when that study was presented. And unfortunately, it did not show that protein restriction was able to make an impact on the progression. However, subsequent analyses of that felt that it was more in the methodology, and practitioners of nephrology do feel, I think, in general, that reasonable protein restriction. Our caller will appreciate this. I know the public won't as much, but, you know, certainly in the range of 0.8 to no more than 1 gram per kilogram of body weight of protein a day it's probably healthy for all of us, but certainly for folks with kidney disease. I think the other thing, too, and I really tried to practice what I preach, because this may not be easy, but I think sodium restriction is very, very important. 80 to 85% of all patients with kidney disease do have hypertension. And while not all of them are salt sensitive, the vast majority are. So what I would always tell patients, if you can initially just eliminate the salt shaker and then try to become aware when you're in the supermarket, you know, look at labels. They all have to list sodium content. And by just trying to avoid or minimize those really high sodium foods, obviously not all of us have the luxury of cooking at home where we can control it more. We don't control it when we go out. In general, processed foods are going to have a lot more sodium. I think the other two things I'd just like to mention, or three things, and that is with more advanced levels of kidney disease, as Ms. Wendell knows quite well, and this will bring a painful smile to her face, but certainly phosphate restriction becomes much more important, because as our kidneys lose that ability, dialysis isn't that efficient in removing phosphate, and it means other medications, and we want to try to minimize those if we can. And then the other two areas would be trying to have a healthy diet with lipids and also sugar. Obviously, diabetes, as our caller mentioned, is a critical factor in kidney disease leading to it. Although the use of cholesterol-lowering drugs has not been definitively shown to slow down progression of kidney disease, we do know that chronic kidney disease is clearly a cardiovascular disease, significant risk factor. So anything we can do for that will help our patients.
Dr. Howard, additional, because before we run out of time, I wanted to get back to one question I had is, along with environmental and social factors, are there genetic predispositions to have kidney disease? And I'm thinking in particular because we know that African American and Hispanics have higher levels of chronic kidney disease. How much of that do you think is environmental and how much may be genetic?
So that's actually a great question and evolving. I think Mrs. Wendell, of course, had the most common genetic disease that we know of. And as you and she both mentioned, it's autosomal dominant. For our listeners, autosomal meaning not carried on the X chromosome. We actually know that the polycystic kidney gene is part of the sixth or seventh chromosome. And dominant, you said it. It means there's a 50-50 chance every child can inherit it as opposed to a recessive 25% chance. But one of the very exciting genetic variants is a gene called apolipoprotein 1, and that's a marker where particularly we've seen more of a predilection to develop more forms of glomerular kidney disease, or to use the term which I'll define for your listeners, glomerulonephritis. This would be a disease that, if you will, leads to inflammation of those kidney filters. And we found that this marker actually can be quite helpful in at least identifying to us those at greater risk of progression. There are, whenever you're ready to get to it, Dr. Myers, there are a couple of really exciting developments, one which you and I talked about briefly the other day that I'd just like to mention for your listeners.
We may have to do it briefly.
One of these, at least, is quite new.
Yes, we may have to do it briefly, but why don't you share that? Oh, can I just go back? I'm not sure we answered the question. Are African Americans and Hispanics more genetically predisposed to have a kidney disease?
So certainly for the African American population, the answer is yes. We do consider that in and of itself to be a risk marker. I'm not telling you that we understand why yet, but we certainly know that if we have an African American referred to us, then we do know, particularly if we do see evidence of progression, we do want to watch that patient very, very carefully, work very hard with that individual to try to put the brakes on the disease process. The other two groups I wanted to mention that we tend to see, if you will, increased kidney disease, but I'm not telling you that we understand whether it's genetic or social determinants of health. But in the Native American population and Hispanic population, also we do see a greater likelihood of progressive kidney disease.
So in the little bit of time left, and I do want to get back to Ms. Wendell before we close, but you want to talk briefly about the new class of medications?
Yeah, so I think the drugs we've known about for some time, and really this data actually goes back to the late 70s, early 80s. I have to credit Dr. Barry Brenner at Harvard with his research for this, but are the drugs we know as ACE inhibitors or angiotensin receptor blockers. Very common blood pressure medicines, but have very unique effects within the kidney filters to attenuate the progression of chronic kidney disease and also to attenuate the spillage of protein, which in and of itself is an independent risk factor. But the very exciting class of drugs, which really has just evolved over the past couple of years, are referred to as the so-called SGLT2 inhibitors or sodium glucose cotransporters. There is a protein in the what we call the proximal tubule. It's the first part of the tubule system hook up to those filters that controls the exchange of glucose and sodium in the kidney. And I remember very well when this was first presented at the American Society of Nephrology several years ago when they identified this transporter and they had developed a compound to block it. We now have three drugs which are out. They're advertised all the time. You can't not listen to TV and not hear them. They are canagliflozin, dapagliflozin.
Well, I have a feeling our listeners are not going to remember those specific names, but yeah. What they will remember from what you just told us is that there are some new and exciting treatments on the way. Right. We only have a couple minutes left. I want to go back to Ms. Wendell for a minute. Are you still there?
Yes.
Okay. Ms. Wendell, so have you been involved with the polycystic kidney community over the years? Are there support groups? Do you stay involved with people who are perhaps starting the journey that you've taken over all these years?
I do participate in the PKD Foundation. Usually it's just for doing the walks and raising money and so forth. I do in the local community, if somebody wants to talk to me about transplantation or things like I'm doing now with you on the radio show here, I do those things.
Did you have people in your life who had gone through it that you talked to, aside from the physicians that you were working with?
Family. Mm-hmm. I have a lot of family members that have the disease. I saw my mother go through dialysis and transplants, and the drugs weren't as good back there, so she did not have a successful transplant. My brother had his wife donated, so she was a living donor. So I was able to talk to him about it. He had his transplant before me. I had a cadaver donor. Mm-hmm. I have cousins that, because I was so successful and put it out there that I had the transplant and so forth, they were not going to get transplants but changed their minds because I was so positive about it. So I have two cousins that have gone through the transplant process because of my successful transplant and being able to explain that to them.
Yeah, and you've done it with such dignity and such courage. I should mention that one of the biggest steps forward has been that many years ago Medicare began covering dialysis, recognizing that it was absolutely life-saving treatment. I want to thank both of our guests. There's so much more we could have talked about, and maybe we will have Dr. Howard back because I think there's a lot more topics to touch on regarding the kidney and the many ways it affects health. Dr. Andrew Howard, thank you from California, where I hope it's sunnier than here in Vermont today. And Ms. Marianne Wendell from Alexandria, thank you for sharing your story. I want to hope all of you will join us next week. February is known as Heart Month, and February 12th is right close to Valentine's Day. We're going to be talking about cardiac health, but in particular, women's cardiac health. Please join us then. In the meantime, be kind to yourselves. Stay safe.
Healthcare Today with Dr. Lewis Myers, brought to you in part by Age Well Vermont, the leading experts and advocates for older adults in northwestern Vermont. Westview Meadows and the Gary Residence, retirement living the way it's meant to be. Kinney Drugs and KinneyDrugs.com, employee-owned and locally committed. And Northfield Pharmacy, pharmacy care with a personalized hometown touch. NorthfieldPharmacy.com.
The music for this program was written and produced by Armin Bayajian.